Good evening, listeners. It is April 28th.
Yes. 9th. 29th.
And you're tuned into 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It is currently just after 6 p.m. And on a Sunday, that can only mean one thing. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Maggie Exton.
And I'm Adrian Gallo. At Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and personal stories of one of these students each week. Now, of course, this week we have our GradX live event with six speakers, so a little bit different than normal. But either way, if you're a graduate student at Oregon State and interested in coming on our regular show, or you just want to find out all about all the awesome things going on at Oregon State, you can check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration. where you can find out all about our upcoming guests and links to our Twitter and Facebook pages.
This is pre-recorded. Should they occur, any opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and their guests and do not necessarily represent Oregon State University or this station.
So again, tonight we are going to be playing a recording of GradX, which was originally recorded on February 22nd, 2018. And this was done as a partnership between the graduate school and this radio show, Inspiration Dissemination, where they wanted to have a TEDx-style event where we really focus on the graduate students and the diversity of graduate students that come to Oregon State, their research, and their personal stories.
Yeah, and so the graduate school reached out to us at Inspiration Dissemination.
And they reached out to us in November, so it was a long time coming. And then each one of the hosts met with the speakers on multiple occasions to kind of help figure out, you know, what are the high points in their story, how to structure the story so that, you know, it really made the most impact for the audience there.
Yeah, and it was really exciting to do as one of the hosts. When Kristen told us in December when we met, it was a really fun event to be a part of, and there's a lot of energy and excitement.
Yeah, so Kristen Finch, our most senior host, she was the first one to get the little flag in her inbox, and she really helped spearhead this whole event. So we have to say a big thank you to her. There's a few other people that we should say thank you to as well.
Yeah, to Andreas and Matthew from the graduate school, they put a lot of effort into organizing and also putting finishing touches on speaker prep and...
Yeah, and I guess we should also say they really advocated for this radio show, Inspiration Dissemination, to be a part of the Grad Appreciation Week, and really kind of made the case to the graduate school and the higher ups that this is an event worth having, and it sounds like we will be having it again next year because it was so successful. We were initially banking on maybe 50 people showing up, yeah. But we had more than that.
We had. I would say at least 100. We don't have an official count, but we ran out of food really early.
And we have some pictures, but I'm guessing at least 100 people, as Maggie said. So that was really exciting. But with an event like this with six speakers, we did have some audio difficulties.
Yeah.
You know, so it's actually really difficult to get different people lined up with two microphones, each one for like the voice projection in the theater and one for recording purposes. So our first speaker, Catherine Jedzik, was nice enough to re-record her talk because I unfortunately was unable to actually get the true recording at the time of the event. So you'll hear a re-recording of Katie's talk. And midway through during David's talk, he is speaker number
five.
Speaker number five. The entire room went blank, as in the projector shut off, the lights for him shut off, his microphone shut off. It was the weirdest thing.
It was like the computer that controls everything decided to restart.
Yeah, it was bananas. So to say we had some technical difficulties was an understatement, but I think we did a good job editing the audio so that you really can't tell that much. But again, David goes in his speech, "What is happening?" Because everything in the room went dark.
And as a tribute to our speakers, they just rolled with it.
They totally rolled with it.
They were so good.
Yeah. Let me think. Is that all we want to say about GradX, I think?
Yeah, I think so. We'll have a little bit more to talk about, I guess, in the intermission.
Yeah, so we're going to play three speakers first, and then we'll have a little music intermission, remind you, listeners, of what you're listening to, and then we'll go back to the next three speakers. Each speaker speaks for about 10 minutes, give or take, and I guarantee you, you will be awed and inspired and just, my goodness, every time I hear these talks, I do get a little tear in my eye, especially during Christoph's, which will be the
second
speaker up after Catherine. So here it is, GradX, brought to you by the Graduate School at Oregon State in partnership with Inspiration Dissemination. I hope you enjoy.
Yeah, and feel free to get inspired.
We begin the evening with Catherine Zizek, a fifth-year PhD candidate in integrative biology. Catherine's advisor is Dr. Eli Meyer.
Hi everyone, my name is Katie Judgek, and I'm going to tell you a story about coral reefs and why they mean so much to me. Coral reefs are often termed the rainforest of the ocean, and it's because of their vibrant colors, the incredible diversity of shapes and structures, and the amazing sea life that exists in harmony, as you see here in this video. It is easy to become entranced in their beauty and mesmerized by the details that make a coral reef a vivacious ecosystem. Honestly, it's hard not to fall in love with them, and I would know. I fell in love with coral reefs at the age of 11. During the summer of 2001, I went on a family vacation to the Caribbean island of St. Thomas. This trip was my first introduction to the ocean. While playing in the sand one day, a girl about my age approached me and asked me if I wanted to see something cool. And I remember thinking, yeah, show me. So I obviously said yes, and I followed her to the water's edge when she suddenly reached down and pulled out a live conch shell and a sea urchin. She then proceeded to drop these animals into my hand, and I was sort of freaked out as they began crawling all over me. I was excited, surprised, and incredibly confused as to what the heck I was looking at. But then she began educating me about these animals and told me she could even show me where she got them. Before I knew it, she was handing me a pair of flippers, a mask, and a snorkel, and told me we were going snorkeling. And I remember thinking, snorkeling? What the heck is snorkeling? Where is the stranger taking me? Well, I was a little apprehensive, but very excited to explore. So here we were in the middle of this bay, and below me, all I could see was seagrass, with some conch shells and sea urchins sprinkled here and there, and I was kind of excited. But it wasn't until about 20 to 30 minutes into our swim that I saw it. I saw a coral reef. I remember stopping in my tracks as it just sort of appeared. There were so many different organisms all in one place. Corals that were yellow and pink, corals that were branching up to the water's surface, as well as these large, massive colonies the size of a small car. There were so many rainbow parrotfish and teeny tiny fish that darted all over the place. My eyes were as wide as my goggles, and I was practically screaming through my snorkel as I kept seeing something new. Well, needless to say, my head was underwater that entire vacation. After that incredible week, I returned back to the landlocked city of Chicago, wondering how the heck I could get involved and connected to the ocean from so far away. I started visiting Chicago's Shedd Aquarium and quickly became involved in their after-school program called Club Shedd. As a fifth grader, I was participating in overnight trips to the aquarium, going behind the scenes and talking with the aquarium biologists and taking part in hands-on research activities. That experience alone taught me so much about all things ocean-related. So as I entered high school, I applied for the aquarium's program called High School Marine Biology, a week-long trip that takes students to the Bahamas to experience life as a marine science researcher. As a 14-year-old, I was coming up with the research questions. I was developing my hypotheses and then going out to the field and collecting the data. I was living and breathing the scientific method, and I absolutely loved it. Here in this photo, you can see me collecting data in the intertidal, which I eventually had to write a paper on and then had to present back to an audience in Chicago. This immersive experience solidified my passion for not only wanting to be a marine biologist, but also for doing research. The second I returned home from that trip, I began looking for colleges that would allow me to pursue a degree in marine biology. I inevitably looked towards the coast, and when it came time to apply a few years later, I decided on the University of Miami in Florida as my top choice. At the end of my first college term, I received an email from the lab of Dr. Andrew Baker, a renowned coral biologist, and he was requesting undergraduate assistants. So without hesitation, I replied, and I started working alongside graduate students conducting research. At first, I was just washing dishes and scrubbing algae off corals, but it eventually led to me conducting my own experiments. I was also really active in the scuba club on campus and took every opportunity to get in the water and visit my favorite reefs. But by the time I finished my undergraduate degree, I started to see devastating changes, not only in the reefs along the Florida Reef Tract, but also in the reefs I visited the very first time in St. Thomas. It was so heartbreaking to see these once beautiful, pristine reefs no longer thriving. Rather, they were struggling to even survive. After observing these changes and becoming more aware of the magnitude of this problem, I knew I needed to do something. Now, when I talk about this change, I'm talking about a process called coral bleaching that is causing mass mortality and degradation of these ecosystems. In this video here, you can see the process of coral bleaching taking place. This video starts out with a healthy coral full of algal symbionts that are brown. And eventually, over time, as the temperature in the water increases, those symbionts that live within the coral tissue are lost, and the coral becomes white, hence the term bleaching. These symbionts provide food for the coral through photosynthesis, and so without them, the coral basically starves. Therefore, if these symbionts don't return to the coral will eventually die. Now, corals protect coastal cities from wave damage and storm surge, like in the case of hurricanes. They provide medicinal compounds that help treat diseases and cancers. They are a source of income through fishing and tourism. And majority of the fish we eat comes from reef ecosystems. So without corals, we could lose coastal protection and protection from disease, lose this important source of protein humans depend on, and miss out on visiting these gorgeous reefs as tourists. And this isn't just happening in the Caribbean. It is happening globally. And it's not just happening every once in a while. Since 2015, we have seen global mass bleaching events every year. Projections estimate that by as early as 2050, almost 90% of the world's reefs could be lost. While the severity and frequency of these bleaching events is alarming, it's important to note that this isn't happening to every individual or every species of coral. When I first saw this image after a bleaching event, I asked the question, why did this individual in the front bleach while its neighbor in the back, right next to him, not bleach? That question is what is driving my research. And I came to OSU to specifically work with my advisor, Dr. Eli Meyer, because this is what he was exploring. My research focuses on the mechanisms that corals may use to acclimate and become tolerant to the changing temperatures, what we refer to as thermal tolerance. I'm also interested in exploring whether thermal tolerance can be inherited and passed over many generations, and eventually lead to adaptation in the population. Over the last 4 years of my research, I've found really exciting results that show thermal tolerance can be inherited and potentially adaptive, and that there are some regions of a coral's DNA that may be responsible for why some corals are more tolerant than others. And that excites me. It excites me because it shows me that there's hope for these coral reef ecosystems. During my time here at OSU, I've realized that I want to use my research to help enact real change for corals. I've taken classes that focus on marine management and policy, which have provided me the skills to think about how we as scientists can use our research and knowledge to help inform management and policy decisions. A large part of this involves improving our scientific communication skills, which I've had the ability to do through workshops that challenge me to communicate to different audiences. And I've been involved in numerous outreach events for young kids and families that gives them the opportunity to learn about corals and the threats that they are facing. All of these opportunities have helped confirm that this is the type of work that I want to do with my career. I want to be involved in outreach and education, research, but also policy. Now, I mentioned a moment ago that my research has some positive outlooks for corals, but it's not just me. My lab mates and colleagues are also seeing these glimmers of hope all around the world. On the opposite side of the world, in the Persian Gulf, we are finding corals that can withstand temperatures around 96 to 97 degrees Fahrenheit. That's 4 degrees above the average bleaching temperature. We're finding coral populations in Australia that are recovering quickly after bleaching events. And with the advancements in technology, we are starting to get a better understanding of how changes in DNA or changes in the expression of certain genes that tell us how corals may be more tolerant. Through all of these examples, I see hope for coral reefs. And I want to make sure that the general public, managers, and policymakers know it too. Passion has connected me to coral reefs ever since I was little. And the experiences I've had along the way brought me here to graduate school. But what drives my motivation currently and after I leave OSU is hope. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Christoph Del Aguilare Errante, a second-year master's student in applied anthropology and public health. Christoph with Pfizer is Dr. Missy Cheney. Please help me in welcoming Christoph to the stage.
I wrote this exactly how I wanted it to be said, and I do not want the integrity of my work to be compromised. I spent a lot of time and I spent a lot of energy investing in these words, so I will stand here in my truth to read what I have to say about me, my work, and accepting those with different abilities, skills, and levels of comfort. In an interview I had a few months ago, an analogy was given to me that I think needs to be shared. A mother of four, a Mexican immigrant who speaks Spanish, was responding to my questions about how she understands what is called autism spectrum disorders, ASD for short. You see, this single mother has not only one child, or two, or three, but four boys who have been given this diagnosis. And I say the word given because that is the word she uses. This mother, let's call her Tia Mari, explained to me this. If you can imagine a house with all its rooms and its spaces, and then you should also imagine a person for each room, maybe even more. One person likes to listen to music while they do their homework, but only certain songs for certain subjects. Another person prefers to play with the family dog and only the family dog. They like to eat with the dog, sleep with the dog, and have some very critical conversations with the dog as well. Another person prefers to be outside, but only at specific intervals and only when homework needs to be done. While the other loves to spend most of their time in the kitchen making the best caldo de pollo that you have ever tasted. All these people, Tia Mari tells me, have a personality. This is how she understands her son's characteristics of ASD. They are four separate people with four separate and distinct personalities. Modos de ser, she says, a phrase which loosely, and I mean loosely, translates as ways of being, because of course in Spanish it means so much more. Personalities, she tells me, are not a disease nor a diagnosis. Si me puedes entender, ponse a pie.
Si me puedes entender, saluda a la persona a su lado. Si me puedes entender, denme una sonrisa grande. Thank you for those of you who were able to understand me and for participating. And for those of you who could not, how would you feel if I told you that you might have autism spectrum disorders? Standing, greeting the person next to you, smiling when being smiled to. Some of you might ask, why not just translate it? And my answer to you is this. You can translate words poorly, but you cannot translate social constructions tied to these words. The importance of each and every behavior, or the significance in being able to follow that series of commands. Commands, by the way, that are used in behavior push behavior techniques, a set of behavioral commands and chains in communication, and applied behavioral analysis, which is used to pinpoint where on the spectrum someone might fall. Behavior, a socially constructed set of actions and ideas of what is appropriate and what is not, is seldom universal. And what is considered socially acceptable here is just as easily aberrant elsewhere. An example, I see many people in this room, and yet I only received a few kisses on the cheek accompanied with an embrace. You see, in my culture, we would say, "Qué mal creados," how poorly raised you are. I came to this country at 6 years old. I was scared and I was lonely, and although I knew two languages, I was taken away from students my own age and put into an English as a second language class, ESL. My friends that I made were also ESL, and those who were not were people with disabilities. ESL and having a disability were combined and separated from everyone else. Not only should that tell you the value the United States places on people who do not speak English or who migrate to this country, but should also speak about the level of concealment the United States has for those who are different in ways of understanding, processing, of looking, and speaking, different ways in their being. My research focuses on these intersections of being Hispanic and Latinx and being a person with a way of being that is called disabled. More specifically, a person with an autism spectrum disorder. Growing up in my Hispanic culture, I came to this country not understanding how or why people who thought and spoke and looked and expressed themselves differently were called disabled. Even now, I see the differences between how families in Hispanic Latinx cultures, and when we define familia, we define it as anyone who looks like us and speaks like us and can cook like us. How families support and give lifelong care for these individuals while this society erects institutions, long-term living facilities, and residential programs. Families in this society themselves disable the abled. I was raised by a rich and powerful and beautiful and ancient line of women and men who are called brujas. Back home in Logroño and in Zugramurdi, España, we do not see the characteristics associated with ASD or of disabilities as a disorder. We see them as markers of a personality specific to that individual. And instead of accommodating the socioculture's strict constructions of norms by modifying and marginalizing and pathologizing the individual, much like what is done in this society, we progress, we make better, and we make accommodating the socioculture for that individual. Being raised as bruja, and being plucked from my home and my people, and placed in this country, I realized how important it was for me to continue on to continue on the culture of healing and not of curing. You see, Hispanic Latinx cultures understand that well-being is a holistic project. Healing does not suggest finality. It acknowledges the ongoing support of mind, of spirit, of family, of body, of culture, of language, of ancestry, and of soul. This is something that I did not think was going to be this hard. This is something that Hispanic Latinx cultures embody and covet. And the way we value people who are different in abilities, in cognition, and in development is inseparable from our identities as family, as an ecology of ethnic cultures, and as a shared experience. My research seeks to bring these perspectives into the framework of disability that this society glorifies. The medicalization of personalities, of people, of cultures, and ways of being. Now, my field has yet to make leaps and bounds in this area because historically, my field of anthropology has remained as colonial as the very people who started it. But as a queer Hispanic person of color and as a student of OSU's Applied Anthropology graduate program, I have found a place where not only are my culture and my languages respected, but so too is the area of my work and the recognition of why it needs to be done. Hispanic Latinx cultures respect and value different personalities, whereas this society seeks to diagnose them. And policies, interventions, and programs should vehemently aim to be informed and be framed by the former. I hope the work I am doing, guided by Hispanic Latinx values and culture, reminds us that whether English is your first language or your second or your third, and whether you are put into special education or not, this following truth will not discriminate. We, all of us, are temporarily able. And whether through age, event, or both, every single one of us will develop a form of what this socioculture calls a disability. And I hope the services we partake in then are much better and much more accepting and accommodating and inclusive than the services we have now. Gracias.
Following Dr. Hand's talk, we will begin our 10-minute intermission. Please help me in welcoming Nicole to the stage.
I like the doctor in front of my name. Looks good. So, when I was 15 years old, when I was a high school student, I told my high school guidance counselor that I wanted to graduate early. She laughed at me. Now at 26, I have a bachelor's, a master's, and a PhD. I've done research in areas from coral reef health assessment to studying proteins involved in human deafness. In these next few minutes, I'm going to tell you exactly how I did it. It started when I was 14. I was a sophomore at the time. I went to my guidance counselor's office, and I told her I wanted to take classes to forego my senior year. She laughed. That interaction was the first time I realized that sometimes it's okay to let the adversity motivate you. I took college courses in the evening and 2 years of summer school. With the moral and financial support of my mom and zero help from that counselor, I graduated high school at 15 years of age. You see, I've learned that self-determination and resilience is like a two-edged sword. It's empowering to be able to do things on your own, to blaze your own trail. But it's also isolating. And when you're isolated, it's hard to realize how things and people fit into your life. How do you define yourself? How do you relate? In asking these questions of myself, I realized I wasn't thriving. I was just surviving. In order to survive, I needed to figure out who I was. I needed to find my passion, my identity, but I couldn't do it alone. I knew I needed a mentor. My very first mentor was a professor named Reese Whitey. She taught environmental biology at Gateway Community College in Arizona. Our interactions during and outside of class led her to becoming my very first research advisor. And once it came time to transfer to a four-year university, she helped me pick my major. Since I lived in Arizona, I assumed that I would land at Arizona State University. But plans changed. My dad committed suicide, and I found his body. In those coming months, my mom made the tough decision to uproot us and move us to Missouri, where she's from, where she has family, in the event that something ever happened to her. It was there that I met my next two mentors that played a pivotal role in who I am today. Their names were Dr. David Emmerich and Dr. Kent Strodeman. During my time with both of them, they encouraged me to explore areas I was unfamiliar with, to research topics in which I had no prior experience but still had an interest. It was their guidance, with their guidance, that pretty soon I became comfortable with being uncomfortable. In the end, not only did I research nitrogen-fixing bacteria at Missouri, but I also got to take part in three separate undergraduate research experiences. The first was at UC San Diego with Dr. David Goff and Dr. Lily Pang. There I studied protein stability using computational methods. My next internship was at Arizona State University with Dr. Jin-Suk Che. There I had the fantastic opportunity to study materials engineering by making microliter-sized microbial fuel cells. These cells are essentially batteries that are powered by bacteria that take chemical energy and turn it into electricity. This internship meant a lot to me because I got to fabricate these fuel cells, and in doing so, it taught me skills I had directly applied to my graduate research. But perhaps one of the most fun internships I did was when I participated in a coral reef health assessment at Phuket Marine Institute in Thailand. There, we constructed artificial reefs. We also assessed the type of fish and marine life that populated natural reefs. All of these things happened because of the mentoring from Dr. Emmerich and Dr. Strodeman. In fact, Dr. Emmerich's mentoring is the reason why I'm standing here in front of you today. He pushed me to apply to a graduate program that had the word biophysics in it. I didn't have a clue what that was, and quite honestly, the word physics still brings up nightmares. I didn't understand how you could take something as beautiful as biology or biochemistry and ruin it with physics. If you'd asked me when I was an undergraduate if I thought of I would pursue biophysics, let alone a PhD in it, I would have laughed at you the exact way my high school counselor laughed at me. So I applied to Oregon State. My PhD advisor, Dr. Colin Johnson, was and continues to be a phenomenal mentor. But even with his guidance, I wasn't meeting the minimum requirements for my program. I was removed from the PhD program, put on academic probation, and put into the master's program. This was a rough setback for me, but it taught me an important life lesson, and that is every setback is just a setup for a comeback. I spent countless hours in the lab. I earned my master's. I got readmitted to the PhD program. I passed my prelims, and I secured my spot as a PhD candidate. At that point, I felt safe to continue my journey to finding my identity, and in doing so, That meant finding a new mentor. One such person is Dr. Dwayne Plaza. He introduced me to the Lonnie B. Harris Black Cultural Center. And it was there that I met members of the Corvallis Area NAACP, members of the Black Graduate Student Association, and other people of color that, quite honestly, I didn't even know were at Oregon State. This was huge for me, because even though I identify as Black, I never really felt like I fit in with the Black community. That changed when I went to the Lonnie B. Harris Center. Dr. Plaza presented me with an opportunity to not only make a difference for people of color at OSU, but within the Corvallis community. Because of him, I joined the Corvallis Area NAACP, where I served as their education chair. This led me to be involved on a city level, where I was appointed by our mayor, Biff Traber, to serve on the King Legacy Advisory Board. I also joined the Black Graduate Student Association. And there, I was elected to be a national representative. But most importantly, for the first time in my life, I didn't feel like an outsider when I was surrounded by Black people. Around this time, I also met Wanda Cornell. And the story behind this is kind of interesting as well. You see, when I first came to Oregon, I always wanted to learn how to hunt. But I didn't know anybody who did it. I eventually got into it. First, I started with archery hunting, turned to rifle hunting. But the more I dove into that culture, the more I realized two things. The first thing I realized was that you don't find a lot of Black people hanging out in the woods. And when I mention my newfound hobby to people in Corvallis, I was often met with being made to feel like some sort of vicious killer, as if hunting is not a form of conservation. The reactions I got once again made me feel like an outcast. I no longer felt safe sharing this part of my identity with people. I put up a wall. This wall changed when I met Wanda. She played a crucial role in me becoming comfortable with identifying as a Black woman that enjoys using Oregon's landscape in a way that most Black people do not. It was Wanda's mentoring that led me to have more of an interest in conservation and natural resources. Between Dr. Plaza and Wanda, I learned that it's okay to have multiple identities. I'll say that louder for those in the back or those that are snoozing. It's okay to have multiple identities. It wasn't until I found my identities that I began to thrive. Just think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. When I found my identity, it laid the groundwork for self-actualization, the peak of his pyramid. I finally had the tools to strive to be the best me that I could be. It started with my dissertation work, where I used optical biophysics to characterize proteins involved in prelingual deafness. Not only did I develop a widely applicable single molecule assay that helps characterize a protein that's involved in deafness, I also published my results in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. In addition, our findings also received press from local news outlets. Next, I was awarded a fellowship by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In the summer of 2017, I spent 10 weeks in Idaho, where I developed a non-lethal assay to detect pancreatic necrosis virus in salmon. Even better, I now have 2 years of direct hire authority with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife. But my success didn't stop there. In finding my identity and then my voice, I learned how to be the change I wanted to see in the world by giving back and enabling those around me. I did this through campus and community outreach, but this doesn't have to be your path. In closing, I want to leave the students in the crowd with 4 pieces of advice. First, I'll say it before and I'll say it again. It's okay to have multiple identities. Second, it's important to find plenty of mentors to help you develop these identities, both professionally and personally. Third, it's okay to fail. Every setback is your setup for your comeback. And finally, it's okay to let the adversity and, quite frankly, the haters motivate you. I listen to a lot of music, and if you catch me around campus, I often have a set of headphones on my head. If I'm not listening to G Herbo on Rantando 300, I'm listening to Young M.A. She's one of my favorite rappers, and there's one line she says that always sticks with me. And it goes something like this. What doesn't break you will make you. So to the motherfuckers throwing stones, thank you.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. All right, so moving right along to our next speaker. Our next speaker is Masood Gorad Abadi, a fourth-year PhD candidate in civil and construction engineering. Masood's advisor is David Hurwitz. Please help me welcome Masood to the stage.
So, 15 years ago, if you had asked me what you want to do in future, no doubt that my response would be, I want to be a movie director. I was raised with Hollywood movies, with Kubrick, with Hitchcock, and I truly wanted to be someone like them. But there was a very big problem. I'm coming from Iran, and cinema industry is not rich in Iran. And I'm coming from a family background that I knew at some point I had to stand on my own 2 feet. So economical pressure made me abandon my dream job and go after engineering majors, which are more thriving in Iran as a developing country. And of course, unfortunately, I've been always good at mathematics. So I started as an undergraduate student in civil engineering. And you can tell for someone with those dreams and goals in his mind, he wouldn't feel passionate about steel and concrete structures very quickly. So it actually took me a couple of years to find myself, to reorganize my thoughts and try to think of things that would still give meaning to me. So give meaning to my life. So two things were left for me. First one was teaching. So I'm coming from a family full of teachers. Even in our daily conversations, we don't talk to each other, we teach each other. We try to give lectures. So teaching has been always a very respectful job for me. And second thing was working on human behavior. So I've been always interested in studying why we do certain things and how we do that, how we react to different conditions. It was late in my undergraduate that I understood, I got familiar with transportation engineering as part of civil engineering, a graduate major in civil engineering. And I understood that there are cool opportunities to work on human behavior, human as a driver, as a bicyclist, as a pedestrian, or even as a household who are going to purchase a new car or replace their old car. So I started graduate school in transportation engineering, and after getting my master's degree, I decided to move to the United States. And again, there were three reasons. First one was that I knew the advanced technology in U.S. would help me go deeper into behavioral studies. Second one was that I knew that I can excel in my teaching skills, and getting a PhD degree from an American university would open new doors for me. And third one was, at some point I thought this is now the only thing that gives meaning to me, to my life, because I was heavily influenced by American culture. And at one point I told myself, if I cannot create a TV show like Friends, I want to go and live in that society. I want to go and make friends like Ross, like Rachel. So I moved here about 4 years ago, and everything has been very wonderful for me. I've achieved much more than what I could think of. And I've achieved all my goals. I have worked very hard. And I just want to jump forward and tell you the end of the story. And that is, just yesterday, I formally signed a contract with California State University in Sacramento. And for the first time in the past 23 years, this fall, I'm not going to start as a student, but I'm going to start as an assistant professor. not the student anymore. So let me talk about my research and some of my challenges. How many of you use a bicycle on a daily basis? Woo! Certainly above the national average. So many cities are encouraging bicycling as an alternative to vehicles. For example, the city of Portland has recently adopted a plan which aims to achieve a 25% mode share for bicycles by 2030. And it means that by 2030, from 4 trips that are made in Portland, one should happen by bicycles. And this idealistic goal comes with its own challenges. First one is safety. As bicycling grows in popularity, conflicts between bicycles and other vehicular types also increases. Data shows that in recent years, despite the fact that total traffic fatalities has stayed the same, the percentage of bicyclist fatalities has increased considerably. The second problem goes back to the idea of social equity in transportation. So data shows that today in the United States, for each 3 men bicyclists, there is only 1 woman bicyclist. And this again goes back to the safety issues. Several studies showed that women tend not to use their bicycles on dense urban environments because they feel less comfortable and they perceive lower level of safety in those environments. And this is against the idea of social equity because we want everyone to use the our urban streets. So we started thinking of the ways that we can improve bicyclists' perceived safety and comfort. How distracting is this? How we can improve bicyclist safety and bicyclist comfort in a dense urban environment like this. So some simple engineering treatments like a pavement color, a colored pavement marking, something like a solid green or a dashed green, or even a warning sign can help bicyclists to perceive a higher level of comfort or safety. So we started a joint project with people at University of Washington to study bicyclist behavior in dense urban environments and how we can improve their safety and their perceived comfort. So we, in addition to a very big and broad online survey, we used Oregon State University Bicycling Simulator. So we are one of the probably 10 labs across the globe that has a full-scale bicycle simulator. This is our bicycle simulator, an urban bike mounted on a stationary platform. There is a very wide screen in front of people, and people would pedal, and they will move in our design environment. We put them in danger without seeing any fatality, of course. We want to see how they react when a vehicle is turning right in front of them or if a truck is pulling out of a loading zone. But what makes our work very unique is actually our eye tracking data. So I can confidently say that we are the only lab in the world that uses a bicycle simulator with eye tracking devices. So our eye tracking equipment let us track the eye movement of our participant. So wherever they are looking on a screen, we can see where they are looking at. So for example, if we are having a warning sign next to the road, we want to first see if they really look at that warning sign. If yes, how long do they look at that warning sign? And then we take that data out and we combine it with the data from our bicycle simulator. So we have more than 70 different variables from our bike simulator device. Everything that you can think of, velocity, lateral position, acceleration, deceleration, steering. So we combine these two, and then we overlay our design, whatever that is, if it is a pavement marking, if it is a warning sign. And we try to test the bicyclist behavior in different conflicts using these engineering treatments and look at their performance. We have had very interesting findings, and I just want to share with you one of them tonight. And it is from our online survey. So we were testing people's perception of comfort in different situations. And what we divided our data set into 4 parts: inexperienced experienced men experiencing bicycling, inexperienced men, experienced women, and inexperienced women. And what we found that was very interesting was that inexperienced women perceive our engineering treatments much better than any other group. In other words, if we put a warning sign or if we put a colored pavement marking on the road, experienced men are not that much influenced by our engineering treatments in terms of their comfort or safety, but it is the inexperienced women who are now feeling safer and more comfortable on the road. And this is exactly what we want. We want to improve the number of bicyclists, but at the same time, we want everyone to use the road. While I've been working on solving some transportation challenges for people in the United States, I certainly have my own transportation challenge. This is my family, my wife and my 2-month-old baby boy living in Corvallis, Oregon. And this is my parents living 7,000 miles away from me in Tehran, Iran. And I haven't seen them for 3 years. And the problem is that I don't know when I can see them again or if I can see them again. Because of an unfair executive order commonly known as travel ban. So this is my transportation challenge today. I cannot travel. I cannot visit my family. I'm Iranian, and Iranians are among the most educated people, educated immigrants in the United States. No Iranian, I emphasize that, no Iranian was ever, never, ever involved in any terrorist attack in the United States. And we are still deprived from our very fundamental human rights, which is visiting our family. And that's all because of some political climate. As I mentioned earlier, I'm going to start a new position at Sac State. And Sac State, the student body at Sac State, comes mostly from Hispanic students coming from very low-income families, very similar to my background. I'm not sure, I don't know where this new position is going to take me. And to be honest, I'm a little bit nervous about being in this new community. But I know one thing for sure. My parents are proud of me, are proud of my education, are proud of my achievements. I will do whatever that I can do. I will go above and beyond. I will do my best for those kids in Sac State so their parents are also proud of them. I want to prove them. I want to show them that no external forces, neither economical pressure nor social injustice can prevent them from being successful. I want to do that, and this is my dream. I have a dream. I have a dream that one day we put away our differences and focus on our similarities, and instead of choosing hate, we choose to love each other. Thank you.
Our next speaker is David Hubert from the Department of Integrative Biology. He's a third-year PhD student studying under Bob Mason. Please welcome David to the stage.
So, I stand before you today, like she said, a third-year graduate student, and I'm an NSF graduate research fellow. I'm pursuing a PhD in integrative biology with a minor in molecular and cellular biology and a graduate certificate in college and university teaching. Now, my current research focuses on the thermal biology of the red-sided garter snake. So I'm interested in how large-scale influences like climate change can affect organisms at a molecular and evolutionary level. Now, in my academic career, I've earned grants, awards, fellowships, honors. I even managed to get published as an undergrad. But things haven't always looked that way. And at one point in time, things looked quite different. So let's go back to the start, where most people begin their college career. When I was 18 years old, I was a high school dropout. I was living in my friend's closet in a punk rock flop house. I was bouncing around from low-paying job to low-paying job. I always expected myself to do more, be more, but I never really made an effort to do that. Fast forward a couple years. At 20, I had just become a father. I had moved in with the mother of my child, and for the first time in my life, found myself with real responsibility. Now, For years, I had been saying that I wanted to become a tattoo artist. And I figured now that I had this responsibility, it was time to make something happen. Now, I didn't know it yet, but this would be the first time where I had started to develop and implement this strategy for success that I'll tell you more about later. So, I wanted to be a tattoo artist. I had been hanging around tattoo shops, obviously getting work done, but more importantly, getting to know the people that worked there. Now, through a combination of these connections and relationships I'd built with the people that worked at the shop and a reputation that I had developed for being a hard worker, I found myself with my first big break. I was offered the opportunity to apprentice to tattoo at a great shop in Portland. I jumped at it. Now, up until this point in time, this would turn out to be the hardest thing I had ever done in my life. It took me a year and a half, 3-hour commutes, 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, but I did it. I succeeded, and I got my tattoo license. Not only that, but I got offered a job at my dream shop right when I finished. So this was surreal. I took the job, and I worked there for a few years. And it was great, until it wasn't. As it turns out, being a professional artist wasn't what I had envisioned. I found myself unhappy and unfulfilled with the work that I was doing. Now, this was tough for me. This was my dream job. I'd always wanted to do this. And it was the first time I'd ever found any kind of success as an adult. Now, it was also around this time that my other interests started to play a bigger role in my life. See, I had developed a hobby with biology. So it all started with fish tanks. So many fish tanks. I think at one point in time, I had 9 fish tanks in one room. Now, I'd find myself going into pet stores, and I would actually know more about the animals in the pet store than the people that worked there. And it didn't take long for my scientific interests to broaden, either. I found myself with several subscriptions to different science magazines. I couldn't get enough of it. So then one day it struck me. Maybe having art as a job and science as a hobby was a wrong approach. Maybe those things needed to switch. This idea terrified me, though. I really wasn't happy with what I was doing, but could I really throw it all away to go back to school? So obviously my track record wasn't very good on that front. Then one day, when I was taking my son to Hatfield Marine Science Center, I stumbled across this promotional video for an aquarium sciences program. Seemed interesting, so I took it home to watch it. So there I was, sitting on my couch in my living room, watching this little promotional video, and I was on the verge of tears. This was it. This is what I had been looking for. This is what I needed. I needed to make this change. That was my tipping point. I had decided I was going to become a scientist. So from that point on, my decision was made. I would start by taking classes at my local community college, and then when I could, I would transfer over to OSU. And a few months before the classes started, and so I gently parted ways with my life as a tattooer. And it was bittersweet. You know, I realized that if I was going to do this and walk away from everything I had worked so hard for, I had to do it right. I had to make it work. Not only that, but if I was going to do this, I had to do it all the way. Going back to school meant getting a graduate degree. Now, starting college as a 25-year-old high school dropout, I kind of knew I had to hit the ground running. I had to come in strong and make my mark fast. Luckily, I did. I finished my first full year of college with a 4.0 GPA, and I earned strong enough letters of recommendation to get a paid internship that first summer. An internship that just so happened to be right back at Hatfield, where I found that video that pushed me over the edge. So when I came back in the fall after doing the internship, that experience left me wanting to become more integrated within the department. I wanted to meet more people and make more connections. My mic died too. Woo! Nope.
So it's restarting.
Oh, awesome. So, teacher voice. What was I saying? So I wanted to meet more people and make more connections within this department. So I decided to seek out a job working within the department. I ended up working as a lab prep assistant. Through this, I found mentorship. I got to know the faculty and the instructors. I even had the dean offering to write me letters of recommendation by the time I was done. By working within the department and making these connections, I made the most out of my time in community college. And the work I had done, along with these connections I had made, set me up perfectly for a similar job when I transferred to OSU. Now, starting at OSU, I was pretty out of place. Not only was I transferring in as a junior, but now I was much older than the majority of the people in my class. I was a father, I was married, and I still had that history of being a high school dropout. What I did have going for me, though, was my motivation and a hard work ethic I had built both in my time in community college and in the jobs I had done prior. I was there because I wanted to be there. I was there for myself, and I was there for my family. I was determined to be successful. So I started by trying to build my place again within this new department. And while this department was much bigger than the one I had been in before, I was lucky enough to get a job working for a large piece of it under the mentorship of an amazing person. Like any good mentor, she gave me opportunities to thrive. The more I proved that I was reliable and hardworking, the more opportunities she would give me. Some of them I nailed, others I struggled with. But I kept open communication and somehow managed to get the tasks done I was assigned. Often these opportunities were not only difficult, but sometimes downright scary. A perfect example of this was my first spring term at OSU. I had been working as a lab prep assistant for the major's introductory biology labs. Basically the same thing I did at the community college, but on a much, much larger scale. So they were working on developing a whole new curriculum for the spring term labs. And in doing so, they needed to simultaneously run the old labs and the new labs. Now keep in mind, there were about 1,000 students taking the class this term. So this was a pretty big undertaking. So I was offered the chance to step up and lead a small staff in the lab setup for all of the new curriculum for that term. I was also offered the opportunity to help write and develop one of the lab modules for that term. And additionally, they also gave me the chance to help teach for the entire term as a TI, or teaching intern. I had never done any of these things before. This was pretty terrifying, but I saw the value in the opportunity, and my mentor believed I could do it. So I said yes to all of it. It's also worth mentioning that my second child was born right in the middle of that term, and I was taking organic chemistry and stats. So, needless to say, this term was crazy. But the labs got set up, my teaching reviews were great, the lab module not only went well, but got published with me as a co-author, my son was born happy and healthy, and I passed my classes. So, I really tried to carry forward this momentum as I finished my undergraduate work. I tried to take every opportunity I could. I found myself teaching different classes and volunteering in several labs to do research. Now, I had continued to work with my mentor, but I had also expanded out to try to connect with more people in the department. When my name came up to help teach my favorite class at OSU, I jumped at the opportunity. I really was excited about being part of such a great class and learning hands-on from the people who taught it. Through this teaching experience and the reputation I had built as a hard worker in the department, I found myself with an offer for a graduate position in the lab of one of those instructors. This position offered me a chance to explore my own interests while working with people I really respected. So I gladly accepted it. Now, it really wasn't until I was able to look back and see how I went from being a high school dropout to a PhD student that I realized that I had had a strategy for success that I had implemented all along. You see, every instance where I achieved something or made any progress, I always use the same steps. I would start by seeking out and surrounding myself with good people. I needed their experience and mentorship to help me move forward and learn. Then I would work really hard for these people, make myself valuable to them and show I was reliable. And in doing so, they would give me opportunities to do more. The more successful I was at these opportunities, the more opportunities I was offered. They were often scary, but most things worth doing are. So this was my recipe for success. Surround yourself with good people. Work hard and say yes when opportunity comes. Thank you.
All right, thanks for being patient. Okay, so our final speaker of the evening is Therese D. Jones, a PhD student in Human Development and Family Science. Her advisor is Dr. Leslie Richards. Please help me in welcoming Therese to the stage.
Well, it's really a wonderful opportunity to be here this evening, and I have really enjoyed hearing my five graduate colleagues who've been able to go before, and conveniently and completely without planning, they have reinforced the veracity of my first point, so I'm happy about that. Tonight, we have really been hearing themes about research and its intersections with questions that matter, the idea that research is a vehicle for change, and we've heard several examples of people who have experienced research precisely as that. And so this brings me to an idea about the purpose of research and maybe a more probative question about exactly what research can be for us. Rather than thinking about research as a change agent for things that are outside of us, what happens if we turn that question inward and think about research as a mechanism for identity exploration, right? So how about this? Instead of asking a person, what do you study? What do you research? We might instead pose the question, who are you? And how does that come through in what you research? I think this accepts the idea or embraces the idea that the particular inquiries of an individual researcher are neither random nor disconnected from the journey that has brought them to that moment in time. So with that in mind, I'm going to attempt an answer at who I am and how that is reflected in the research that I conduct. So who am I? Well, many things could be said. I'm a student of social policy. I am a wife and a mother. I'm a daughter of a woman who did not graduate from high school, who struggled financially to support her children, who amazingly knew the words to every single song that ever came on anywhere, and would have no shame about correcting you when you were wrong. I am a sister to a younger sibling who I hoped very much through my efforts to reduce the challenges that she experienced coming up in poverty by creating a pathway that she could follow. Sometimes I was a sister who dragged her along against her will to follow that path, which created some fun interactions later. I'm a community organizer. I like to invest in my community. I serve on the school board. I am involved with nonprofits. I am the product of a rural environment with a decent school district, but an even better social gossip network, which is important if you live in a rural community. If you're from a rural community, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But maybe most relevant to this particular moment in time, I am a story. I'm a narrative of the spaces and places that I have occupied and those spaces and places that I've invited to dwell within me. So that has brought me to this moment in time, leading me here right now. Along the way, some of those spaces that I've occupied have been a homeless shelter in Seattle where I worked for several years, a journey to Chicago that brought about some of the best friends a person could have, a heartbreaking decision to leave those friends and come out to the Northwest to be closer to family again, a dynamic now 7-year-old, and 16 years of marriage to a very tolerant and patient life partner are just some of the spaces and places that I have occupied. So to really think about how my research reflects what I care about in my own story, I would ask you to picture with me a nice steep hill. And at the bottom of that hill is a little tiny orange house, about 700 square feet, with matching orange shag carpet that I still cringe at whenever I look at old photos. And in that house is a mom, two daughters, one bathroom, which created problems later. And at the top of the hill was the elementary school where I would attend school. 6 years of walking up and down that hill, 5 days a week, rain, snow, not really, sometimes. And along the way, as I would journey up that hill, I would pass landmarks that helped me mark my way, how close I was to school. There were lawns that got a little bit more manicured along the way, houses that got a little bit bigger, people who reflected the status that went along with some of those houses. I passed the Mr. Anderson, whose newspaper he was always picking up in his ratty blue robe as I was passing his house. And a few years later, I would deliver that paper in the wee hours of the morning and then see him later picking it up. I would pass the house of the middle school librarian, who later introduced me to books that changed my life. I would pass the home of the owner of the True Value store in town, the home of my high school history teacher. At the very top, the retired chief of police lived, and right on the other side of his house was my elementary school. There were also some classmates sprinkled in along the way, and as I walked up the hill, I would see them ahead of me, and I would think to myself, darn, they live closer. They got to watch one more round of Ramblin' Rod cartoons this morning because they didn't have to leave as early as me. I love a good math problem. Honestly, who doesn't, right? So I calculated how much further I walked to go to school than the classmate who lived the closest, and over 6 years, it was almost 500 miles. That's a long way, a lot further than my classmate who lived the closest that I journeyed to get to the same destination for the same purpose, right? To go up to experience our elementary education together. We had different starting places. We were intending to arrive at the same destination, but clearly our journeys were not the same. That classmate at the top of the hill never got to see Mr. Anderson's ugly robe. So this raises a key question that has informed my research interests. How does the starting place in life influence the journey to where you will end? The presumption in that question is that by considering where a person starts out, we recognize that different starting places mean different opportunities or different lack of opportunities, different resources that might be available, different relationships that will be built. The point being that regardless of the fact that the final destination may be the same, the point at which you enter that road changes what you experience along the way. So holding on to this idea about starting places mattering, I want to shift to the areas of social policy that have captured my attention and think a little bit about how starting places in life might intersect with these particular policies to create different outcomes for people. So my interests are in health policy, housing policy, and education policy. And those three aren't random. I think there's a strong relationship between them. So health policy allows us to ask a question, and maybe ask yourself right now, how are you? How is your physical health? How is your mental health? Do you have the resources that you need to have the kind of level of wellness that you would like to have? Housing allows us to ask the question, where are you? Considering, and we've had some discussion already this evening about the idea of location mattering. Where are you? Do you live in a neighborhood that has safe bikes? Do you live in a place where your doors and your windows will lock and you're able to feel secure? Do you live in a place where it feels comfortable to go outside after dark if you need to run an errand to the store? Where are you? And then lastly, thinking about education policy, maybe a question can be, who can you be? What kind of opportunities do you experience in your education that inform the possibility of a future self? What can come next for you is hugely tied to what comes onto your radar and when it comes onto your radar. Does it enter your life at a point in time when you're receptive to the idea of possibility, that you're able to incorporate it into a vision for what might come next? The intersection of these policies positions a person toward opportunities of advantage or disadvantage. If these areas of life are stable, if you have stable housing, if your health is well, if you are have access to education, then you're positioned maybe for advantage. Opportunities that will allow you to make the best of your circumstances and accrue more with those. But if these areas lag, then you may be more positioned to experience disadvantage. And the advantages and disadvantages have a bit of a cumulative effect over the life course. So if you have early advantage or early disadvantage, over time, those manifest. The advantage will produce more advantage,
But disadvantage will yield more disadvantage as well. So think about it as a checking account. If you have a positive balance in your checking account, you've got an advantaged checking account. Even if you don't really do a whole lot, your checking account is going to maintain its value, can maintain its value. But if you start out with a negative balance, unless you intervene, your negative balance will continue to grow. You'll be further and further from being able to be balanced. And the power of social policy is its ability to be an intervention that disrupts this disadvantage. It can be a tool of equity to achieve inclusion that allows us to no longer allow predictors such as country of origin or language, sexual orientation or gender identity, parental educational attainment, or family's income to be predictors of your future. Social policy has the potential to create an equalizing opportunity where these categories might otherwise be able to disproportionately predict a person's success. Well thought out social policy that focuses on an equity lens can disrupt that possibility and create opportunities for advantage that might not be there otherwise. This has been true in my life. I mentioned that I grew up with a parent who did not graduate from high school. I did not have a lot of money. We relied on what we would consider to be entitlement programs to make ends meet. By all accounts, I would be a person for whom disadvantage should have yielded more disadvantage, but access to various policies allowed my family to stabilize and allowed me to have an opportunity to advance forward. So thinking about social policy, I tried to think about it in the context of a narrative. I like qualitative research, so I like stories. If you can ask a question that will yield a story, then that's a good question. The longer the story, the more you have to work with, right? So I try to think about social policy in the context of a story, this idea of it as a tool of equity. And I thought about my son, who attends a bilingual dual immersion school here in Corvallis, one morning not long ago. It was a Monday, and I think Monday malaise had a hold of him, and so he was just really being pokey, getting ready for school, dragging his feet. "Mom, I don't want to go to school today." And he has a flair for the dramatic side, so this was not a quiet conversation, as he's telling me, "I don't really want to go to school today." So I say, "Well, why not? What's happening? You know, you usually enjoy school." He says, "Well, Mom, it's Spanish week." So I take that to mean this is the week that classes begin in Spanish and then switch to English later in the day. So I say, "Oh, that's hard, isn't it?" "Yeah, I can see how that would be hard. What's tough about it for you?" "Well, it's hard to start out the day not understanding what's going on." "Yeah, I'm sympathetic to that. I get that. I start a lot of my days having no idea what's going on. So I'm right there with you." The subtext that isn't getting said out loud: "A lot of my moments with you, I do not know what is going on. So I really understand what you're saying here." So thinking quickly, I say, "Okay, think about your friend." I won't name the friend because Corvallis is a small community. "Think about your friend whose family speaks Spanish at home. He's primarily speaks Spanish. What do you think it's like for him when school starts in English?" My son pauses for a second. I can see that he knows the answer, and he's just waiting to actually admit it. And then he finally says, "It's probably really hard." "I think it probably is really hard." And so I say to him, "You know what I really love about your school? I love this about your school, Quinlan. You guys take turns having things be difficult. It's not ever the same amount of hard for every person every single day. It's hard for you when you start in Spanish. It's challenging for your friend when you start in English, but you're sharing that responsibility." And for me, social policy with an equity lens is designed and is perfectly suited to help us create a culture and a society where no single group of people has to consistently find it hard to get through the day, because we can create opportunities to share that burden. Life is hard. Social policy is not going to make life not be hard. It's also not going to make us all the same, but it can create a context in which hard is not always borne on the same shoulders of the same individuals, and where each of us has an opportunity to step up and take our turn, having things be hard or uncomfortable. And in doing so, social policy with an equity lens has the ability to verify in a very public way the dignity and the value that each of us brings to every facet of our life. I love the idea that with social policy as an equity lens, every person can find the way in which society clearly calls out that they matter, that we are the better because they are there. And that is the reason that I study social policy. And I appreciate the opportunity to share that with you this evening. Thank you very much.
I just want to thank you all one more time for sharing this event with us. And I want to thank the speakers who rolled with punches with all of our technical difficulties still gave great, great presentations. So, thank you.
I also wanted to give a special shout out to Inspiration Dissemination. Without Kristen and Adrian, this would have never happened. And also without all the other folks at Inspiration Dissemination. If you're here for Inspiration Dissemination and you help with this process, please stand up so that we can acknowledge you. We spent here long and hard with all the speakers to make sure over the last 2 months to make sure that their stories were crafted so that they'd be prepared for this evening. So thank you for your labor and for being here. And we're just really grateful and really excited.
All right, one more round of applause for our speakers.